Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. No waiting for the kettle. It's just there, like magic. I love mine. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's hour is 15 questions to Charlie Higson. Charlie Higson is a very talented man. He's an actor, he's a writer, and he used to be the front man in the two-tone band The Higsons. I've interviewed him so many times. Recently, I interviewed him about his children's book, Worst Holiday Ever. Very good read. I'll have to tell him about that when I speak to him. My daughter is really enjoying reading that. I also interviewed him. He did a load of young James Bond novels. I remember interviewing about that. I've interviewed him about so many different things. Just recently, he started an excellent podcast about classical music called Charlie Higson and Friends. But I think he's best known for writing and performing in The Far Show. Let's meet him. Here's Charlie Higson. Charlie, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, it's lovely to be here, Tim.
I just said in the intro, the last time I interviewed you was about your book, Worst Holiday Ever. I've been sitting reading it with my eight-year-old, and I have to say she loves it. She's engrossed in it. And she feels really proud that she's able to read a book, because it's quite advanced for an eight-year-old, but it's such a lovely way. She loves it when she gets to the listen thing, so thank you for that.
Oh, well, that's great. You know, I mean, it's interesting, you know, because she's eight, she's probably a couple of years younger than the sort of target readership. But that's the thing with kids' books. It's really difficult to specify what age, because people always say, when I tweet about it, they say, oh, what age is it for? I say, I don't really know.
Yeah.
Adults can enjoy it just as much as kids. And, you know, some kids are more confident readers. But yeah, I mean, that thing of reading a book with your kid is fantastic. And they always like to read something that they feel is a bit more grown up
than they're at. It really is too advanced for her. But I've got to say, and I'm not just saying this because you're on the podcast, but the English is brilliant for her. Using poor English to describe it. But it's so good because she can read all the words. And then, you know, as I say, it's quite bitty. So the chapters aren't too long. She keeps getting to bits where she loved it when she got to bits where it's like a conversation and you've done it as a conversation rather than,
yeah,
in sort of like bold and italic or something. She just thoroughly enjoyed it. So yeah, brilliant. Excellent. Well done on that. Yeah, really good. And I was just mentioning you used to do the young James Bond novels as well. How many of those did you do?
I did five and some other sort of bits and pieces around them. That was my first foray into writing for kids. I wrote four adult crime books in the early 90s, and then The Far Show and TV took over, and I didn't write again for a long while until I was approached by the Ian Fleming estate, who said, would you have any interest in writing some young James Bond books? And I had three boys, and you know, I was always looking for books that they might like. And I thought, well, I'll write one. Yeah. I'll write one that they might like. And, you know, James Bond is one of the few things that was cool when I was a kid that's still cool now for kids.
Yeah.
So it was quite, you know, they had a bit of kudos at school that their dad was the guy that wrote the James Bond books. rather than the kid whose dad wrote the Rainbow Fairies books.
I don't want to slag off other celebrities writing books, but there are
There
are a lot of them doing it, and I've picked up a few of them to try and read with my daughter. And you know, some of them are just badly written. It's like me attempting to write a book. I think there's a skill to it, you know. It's like, but I just think celebrities think it's easy to write for children. I'm not sure it is. Watching the way my daughter's consuming your book, I can tell you, it's, you know, there's a real art to it.
No, well, you know, I mean, famously Martin Amis, when someone said to him, "Would you consider writing a children's book?" He said, "You know, only if I'd had a stroke." And he was. Whether he was implying that he met, I don't know what he was implying exactly, but it's much harder to write a good book for kids than for adults, because kids are quite fussy. They don't like something, they won't bother with it. Adults, we have this thing, we started a book and we really better finish it.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not clever enough to get to understand it all, but I'll really make an effort because the writer's gone to it. It's nonsense. If you don't like a book, ditch it, throw it out the window. But kids, you know, if you can't grab them and hold them and speak to them on their level, then don't bother. I mean, there are some celebrity kids books like mine, that are brilliant. You know, I do think, for instance, that David Walliams, he's a good kids writer. I think perhaps he's written too many, and, you know, it's a danger that you spread yourself a bit thin. But his early books were great, great books for kids that kids really loved. David Baddiel, again, his books are really popular. And, you know, he's kind of found his thing. But there are other books, like Madonna wrote some kids' books. Big splash. They all sold a lot. Bestseller charts. And now they've disappeared. I don't think you could find them anywhere. Mm. So the good books, the ones that are actually really good books, they stand the test of time, and they'll still be around for kids to read in the future. It doesn't matter who's written them. In the end, it just matters whether it's a good book.
I'll tell you off the podcast the one that I really don't like. Right, right, let's get on with these questions. We've got
three. Right.
We probably won't get through them all, but let's give it a go. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Don't worry so much. I never had a career plan. I haven't really ever had a proper career. I've done all sorts of different things. I was a singer for a while. I was a decorator for a while. I was a very good decorator. I was a better decorator than I was a singer. and, you know, I'd met some people at university, and through them got started doing comedy and TV stuff. And it just happened. And, you know, I think particularly young people now, that it's instilled in them, you've got to have a career plan. You know, if you go to university, you've got to choose the right degree. And it all becomes about making your mark and having a career and a plan. But it's not. Life doesn't work like that. Life works as a series of random encounters, and things happen, and you make connections and go from one to another. So don't get so stressed about it. Just try and enjoy yourself as you go along.
What university did you go to?
I went to the University of East Anglia, UEA, which used to humorously be called the University of Easy Access. But actually it was a much smaller university in my day, but they did do some really interesting courses there, and some quite progressive courses. So I went in 1977. I did English and American Literature and Film Studies. And it was there that I met Paul Whitehouse and the guys that I formed my band with, and through other friends there I met Harry Enfield and Vic Reeves. So it, you know, going to university is about the people that you meet and the connections that you make, much more than it is about the subject you study, unless you're doing, you know, medicine or something.
What was Paul Whitehouse studying?
He was doing something called development studies, and he never worked out what it was. It was one of the progressive sort of left-wing courses that the university did, because I think it started in the sort of late 60s. And it was a sort of combination of geography, politics, and sociology, and the whole thing about developing nations and our relationship with them and how we work. You know, it was sort of anti-colonialism and all that stuff. He just wanted to do geography, and that's what he thought he was doing. He hadn't properly read the syllabus, as you didn't in those days. I don't even remember particularly why I chose to go to UEA. Actually, no, it was one of the only two places that did the course I wanted to do. But for him, you know, he went there and he lasted nearly a year. So that was quite well done.
So when was the first time you met Paul then? How did that come about?
Well, you know, this was 1977, so it was the height of punk rock. And most people at the time were still wearing flares. I was wearing short trousers. I was a nice middle-class punk boy. But I had, did I say short trousers?
Yeah, do you mean tight?
I mean straight trousers.
Right, okay.
Yeah, straight and quite tight trousers. And So I sought out anybody else at the university who also had straight trousers. And Paul was one of them. And in fact, the first time I saw him, he was wearing white trousers, white jeans. And I think he'd written some punk anarchist slogans down them in the style of The Clash. He had, until quite recently before going to university, he'd had a long curly perm, a sort of Kevin Keegan look, but he cut it all off and became a punk. And he actually is a lot more working class than me. But we hit it off straight away and we formed a punk band together, the Right Hand Lovers. We kind of, we rounded up all the other kids there who had straight trousers. And we played to all the kids who had straight trousers at the university and in the town. So, I mean, it was great fun. It was really good.
How does Vic Reeves fit into that then?
He was a friend of mine called Alan Davidson, who Vic Reeves fans will know the name because Vic used the name Alan Davidson for the title of his fox puppet, Alan Davidson, the Filthy Fox. But it was based on his old mate from up the Northeast. And Alan was at university. He was a really nice guy, really interesting guy. I was really into books and films and all the stuff that I was into. And it was through Alan. He kept saying, oh, you know, I've got this mate who does comedy. You must come and see him and do some stuff. So I met Jim, or Chin, as he was known then, Jim Moyer, through Alan. And so, yeah, in the early days when Vic Reeves was doing little bits and pieces that... Paul and I did little bits and pieces with him.
What was that like, though, to go and see Vic Reeves? And I assume Bob Mortimer was with him at the time.
I mean,
it's quite weird what they were doing, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, it was. But it was the funniest and the best thing I've ever seen on stage. It was like nothing anybody else was doing. I managed to catch it. I think the last time they played the Goldsmiths Tavern they were all based down in South London, round Deptford, round Goldsmiths Art School. And there was a lot of arty types involved and artists and performance artists and concept artists who would do odd acts in the show. And it was amazing. Every week they'd put on a new 2-hour show, a variety show that Vic Reeves would host, Britain's best light entertainer. And he'd go off and come back on as other silly characters, and Bob would come on and do bits and pieces, and all their mates would do bits and pieces. And it was like a sort of art event. It was also a music event. They'd have musicians playing. But it was also just the comedy was just incredible, because it was that mix of very mundane references and that sort of deadpan northeastern humor mixed in with sort of Dadaist art references. And that was I found a very alluring mix. And as long as you just went along and enjoyed it and didn't try to figure out too much, it was fantastic. So I said to Paul, you've got to come and see this guy if he does some more. Got Paul down, and then we just pestered him and said, look, we'd love to be in the show. So we started appearing when they did it at the Albany Empire, which is a much bigger theater in Deptford. And because it was all in South London, the London media completely ignored it. So it was very much a sort of local culty thing. But they did a new 2-hour show every week for about 10 weeks.
I always think the most amazing thing about it is how it got commissioned. Knowing about TV commissioners and the way it works, the idea that ended up on TV, I still find it astonishing.
Well, if you went there, you had this packed theatre, and it was pretty big, full of young people who were really into this show. They knew all the catchphrases, the sing-along bits, the shout-along bits. And there was an energy, and you could, you know, Vic on stage in his white suit, he had a fantastic charisma and energy and presence and star quality, and a combination of him with the very sort of deadpan small scale Bob Mortimer was just amazing. And the TV commissioners competed I think there was a competition between BBC Two and Channel Four to get the show, and various, agents were after him, and TV production company. So it was Jonathan Ross's TV production company that nabbed them and made the show for Channel 4. But honestly, if you'd been there and seen the show, it's, you know, we're all old men now. We're in our 60s. And there must be a lot of young people. They see the likes of me and Vic Reeves on TV and think, well, I don't know, what are these old people doing? But when you saw him there as a young man, fresh, nobody had seen anything like it before. You just thought that this is something really special. And they quite cleverly worked out how to distill that kind of 2 hours of entertainment into a tight little half an hour show.
There's something so amazing about interviewing Vic and Bob, either of them or both of them together, when they come on Sunday Brunch. They just throw little snippets in of just pure genius comedy that no one else thinks of. And every now and then they just fire it in, and I absolutely love it. They always thoroughly enjoy having them on the show because it's so different to the way a lot of other people think in their comedy.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the great thing that, you know, that Bob always says about Vic is that he just does not give a shit. He doesn't matter if something is successful or not successful. He doesn't matter if he's played the game or towed the line or not. He just does what he wants to do. And that, you know, that is a great thing to have in TV. But yeah, you know, it's like the relationship with Bob and Paul on their fishing show. You know, again, Bob comes out with stuff. You say, well, you know, where does that come from? And it's not faked. It's not forced. That's the way his mind works. I read his autobiography for him. He said, look, oh, Charlie, can you read this and tell me if it's shit? And it's brilliant, as you would expect. And it's just him, you know, and it is that combination of his funny little northern life where it sort of plods along and not much happens. And then these extraordinary, ridiculous things happen, the sort of things that he tells on Would I Lie to You? And you never can tell if he's lying or not. And he's normally not lying.
Yeah, well, I mean, the lot of you are all just unbelievably funny and talented. And interestingly, your podcast is the reason why we've got a mutual friend. And I texted her as soon as I'd heard the podcast. I went, this is just the best listen ever. Please, can you ask Charlie whether he can do my podcast? Just, you've got Paul on it and Bob on it talking about classical music. And it's just it's truly such a lovely listen. Everything about it is wonderful. You just immerse yourself in not only there's snippets of classical music, but the language you all use, the way you talk to each other, the fondness you have for each other. And also it's funny. It's just it's such a lovely listen. I love that podcast. It's brilliant.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, it's hats off to Scala Radio. You know, I'd done some bits and pieces for them because I'm really into classical music and I'm really into the idea of trying to get more people to listen to it and young people to get into it and to not be scared of it. And they said, look, can you do this show? It's a 2-hour show and you just chat to your friends. I said, what, I like 2 or 3 a show? No, just get one person on, talk to them for 2 hours, you know, an old friend. And that's great to have that space to do that, the time to do that. And on the show, you know, we played the pieces of music in full. And they said, look, you know, you guys have recorded way more than we can fit into the show with the music. But how about we put it out as a podcast where we only do snippets of the music and do the chat at full length. And it is just me talking to friends. And, you know, I'm glad that people have been enjoying it and getting into it. And also quite a lot of people have been saying, oh, it's lovely to hear this music. I didn't know it before. So it's been,
oh, I love it. It's really, really good. And the fishing show, by the way, I went to the launch of it and you interviewed them.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel I was so privileged. They hammered you and they were just hammering. Everyone was hammering everyone in such a lovely way. And I came away and I actually went and met you all in the bar afterwards and I was having a chat. And I was just like, I feel I was so privileged to actually not only see a preview of the show, but then to have you interview the two of them. It was pure gold, really.
Well,
good.
Again, you know, we've known each other for so long and we trust each other. We can add, you know, English blokes show their affection by taking a piss out of each other. So, we did another of those actually up in Manchester at the Comedy Store for the release of the book. And again, it was really great to do that with just, you know, an audience to come along. And we've talked about possibly maybe trying to go on the road with a show like that. But of course, COVID and everything in the last year has put paid to that. But, you know, it is fun to just talk to your friends. And when they're funny guys like Paul and Bob, it's a gift and a joy.
Yeah, and you, the three of you are just quick and it's funny. Right, let's do, we're never going to get through any of these questions, but let's go for
how many have we done?
One. What is the best moment of your career?
Oh, there are so many marvellous moments. It was probably when I got off with that Hollywood film. No. it's really hard to pin down. I mean, I think in some ways, it was possibly the publication of my first novel, which is called King of the Ants, was out in 1991. Because that was the one thing I've done in my career that was just me. I mean, obviously you work with publishers and agents and things, but you know, that was just me. I had written a whole book, and to see it there in a bookshop was a sort of validation and a vindication. You think, well, you know, that's it. I'm a published author now. I didn't realize at the time that getting it in the bookshop is the first step of a very, very long, hard slog to try and get people to actually read it and then want to buy another one. But in some ways, you know, that for me felt like a, because I'd dust around doing other things. As I say, I was in the band and I'd been doing TV stuff with Harry Enfield and Paul by that time. But that was kind of, okay, there's a book with my name on the front. So in some ways that was it.
My favorite part of your career is the Fast Show, if you need to know. But
well, yeah, but I thought you wanted like a sort of more specific moment rather than years or 10 years or whatever of my life. But yeah, I mean, obviously the Fast Show is the most successful thing I've ever done and the thing that will probably have the most lasting legacy, if we can talk about such things.
The wonderful thing about the Fast Show is the same thing. I'm sure you've heard this story a million times. The first thing that happens is you watch the Fast Show and go, what the fuck is this? What is going on? This is rubbish. This is not exactly the same way that you first watched The Young Ones. Exactly the same way you first watched Vic Reed's Big Night Out. You go, this is nonsense. Within a couple of weeks, everyone, you're going, I've got to watch this. And you know all the catchphrases. Is that what you've heard from many people?
Yeah, very much. And, you know, people forget that now because they're so used to it and they've seen it and they've seen clips of it and they look at bits on YouTube. It sort of seems familiar and ordinary. But at the time, it was groundbreaking. I don't know. But, it went out in a sort of late night, obscure Tuesday night slot. It was kind of slipped out there. And, I remember Matt Lucas saying the same thing as you said, and he'd had the same thing with Vic and Bob. He'd actually written in to complain after the first to the BBC after the first episode of not the BBC Big Night Out was Channel 4.
Channel 4.
He wrote in to complain to Channel 4 saying, what are you showing this rubbish for? And then by the end of the series he was just like the biggest fan. But yes, people did find it weird and off-putting when we started on the Fast Show. Paul and I, we approached it a very specific way. The first series was 1994, and it was very clear that the way people were consuming television was changing. We'd had, videos and DVDs were starting to come in, that whole digital thing. It's the idea that people could watch something over and over again. And for us, our sort of target audience was a band on a tour bus saying, oh, put the Fast Show on again. Right. So we thought we want to make something that stands up to being repeated. But also we want to make something that the more you watch it, the more you get out of it. It pays off the repetition. And so we constructed it in a different way. You know, as classic sketch show, you look back at things like the Two Ronnies or whatever. Some of the sketches on there are like 8 or 9 minutes long.
Yeah.
And then on other sketch shows, you'd have your sort of standard sketches. You'd have your setup. What's going on here? Who are these people? They're at a party. Oh, this guy's saying this. Oh, I see. There's going to be a punchline there 3 minutes later. And so you'd have your classic sketches, and then you'd maybe have a little package of quickies. And if you had one running gag quickie, you'd run it through a show. But we said, no, let's try and make the whole show sort of running gags. And they will run through the series. So you might watch the first one in episode one and think, well, what? And of course, now people watching it, they've seen all the other versions. So they're in on the running gag and the joke. But then it was like, hey, well, what was that bit? And then you see the next bit the next week and it's repeated. By the end of the series, you're kind of looking forward to those bits and how they might change and pay off. And you know, we really did cut the sketches to the bone. We thought we wanted to do a sketch show that was just highlights.
Did it feel like having been in a band and not successful? Sorry.
We were a reasonably successful indie band when such things meant something. We were number one in the indie charts with our first single. It was all downhill after that. But we were not that successful.
But when you've got people quoting you, like everyone in a pub, everyone, all mates turn around, you're just quoting the lines at each other constantly. Is that like having a hit single?
Well, I guess so. But I mean, obviously, if I'm in the pub, the people aren't around me quoting lines. I've heard that other people are in pubs doing these things.
Yeah, but as you walk down the street, people must be shouting the lines at you.
No, you see, the interesting thing is, and a lot of people say this about hit TV shows, it's probably different now when we got social media and everything is very instant. But with the Fast Show at the time, it took a while. It took to maybe even by the third series to really take off. And it always was a sort of smaller scale BBC Two show. Harry Enfield show had three times the viewing figures that we had. It was big deal on BBC One. We were BBC Two. And, you know, you look at Monty Python at the time, and when they were making Monty Python, they'd already made a couple of sketch shows. Those guys who were making just another one seemed to be doing all right. They weren't sure. Maybe they'd do something else. And they were all looking at other things to do. It's only as time goes by and you start looking back that it becomes a big deal. And I've got the sort of face that is fairly bland, and I rarely get recognized. But you know, if I'm out with Paul or Simon, or who've got more noticeable features, should we say, you know, they get noticed all the time and stopped, and then they'll sort of say, they'll turn to me eventually and go, oh, look, there's another one.
Yeah.
But no, at the time we were making a show, we loved making it. It was popular. It had a sort of growing cult appeal. And it's really only over the years that you've heard people say, oh, you know, I was a kid and we all did it in the playground. And you know, it was great because we could all sit and watch it with my parents and the family together. It wasn't like being number one on Top of the Pops. You didn't have that moment of there you were. Which I actually did, funnily enough, having spent 6 years as a singer in a band, paying my dues. We all thought, as everybody in a band has to think, we are going to be huge one day. We're going to have a massive hit. We're going to be vindicated for all this hard work we've done in slogging around in a minibus and playing every gig going. Eventually, we will get onto Top of the Pops. In fact, it was one of the reasons we split up. We had a massive argument about where we were going to put the drums when we got on Top of the Pops. But after 6 years, I think the highest chart position we got was number 73 with a cover of an Andy Williams song, Music to Watch Girls By, and then moved on to comedy and things took off. We did Stavros and Loads of Money with Harry on Saturday Night Live. That took off. Loads of Money became absolutely massive.
Yeah.
And a friend of ours in the music biz said, well, why don't you do a novelty record? So we did. We spent a day in the studio with William Orbit, who went on to become one of the biggest producers around. And we knocked together a single, Loads of Money, Doing Up the House. It went to number two in the charts. And we went on Top of the Pops.
And the drums.
There weren't any. But it made me, that was a real eye opener about how showbiz works, how the music business works, how everything works. It's not about paying your dues. It's not about being real. It's about having the right thing at the right time that someone wants, getting it out there, putting it in front of them, and bang, you've got a hit.
Yeah. What is the, going to get on to the next question now then, what is the worst moment of your career? Do you have one of those?
Well, you know, I've done, over the time, I've done things that haven't done as well as other things. Whether that's a worst moment, I don't know. I mean, everything we've always done, we've tried to make as well as possible. It's something that we are proud of. And we did this radio series called Down the Line, which was a spoof radio phone-in show for Channel 4, Radio 4, which was really popular, and people still listen to it a lot. And we did a TV spin-off version of it called Bellamy's People, which, despite our best efforts, we couldn't get people to watch. And the BBC didn't recommission it, despite the fact that we had enough material for two series, because it was improvised. It was a different way of making comedy for us. And people don't people didn't watch it. People don't particularly remember it, but we think it was a great show. We still do. And in fact, you know, it's it was perhaps one of those things that was before its time. I don't know. But whether that's a worst moment, I don't know.
For this month, the Lovejoy Hour is sponsored by Mainbrace, a premium golden rum that has just won gold at the Rum Masters. It's delicious on its own, or you can pair it with tonic or ginger ale, or of course, you can use it in cocktails. And this week, as a special treat for our listeners, if you buy a bottle of Mainbrace premium rum, they will give you a case of Fevertree tonic for free. Use the code CHEERSTIM. That's the code CHEERSTIM. The offer lasts until the 31st of May. What does success mean to you? Is that it? Your own control over your own work?
I think, you know, again, going back to what advice you get to people is if you can do something in your life that you enjoy and that you can look forward to going to work on a Monday morning, that is the best thing. And if it pays you money as well, that is obviously great too. But honestly, you know, I've never had a proper job. I've been self-employed. I've done my own stuff. I've worked for myself all my life. And sometimes you've had lean years and some things haven't been a success, but I've been able to say, well, that was me. I was doing it. I was making it and I was really enjoying it. And so I think, yeah, as you say, success means being able to do things how you want to do them exactly and in the way you want to do them.
Yeah, I've never gone into Sunday brunch or Soccer AM or something for the weekend or my main TV shows. I've never gone there thinking I don't want to be here. I've always gone there thinking I can't wait till we go live. This is so exciting. And then seeing what the guests are going to do and everything. I just love it. I can't imagine life without doing it.
And you've also produced quite a lot of your stuff, haven't you?
Well, I did back in the Soccer AM days where we basically just used to watch you and Vic and everything else. We just used to steal all your material because we didn't know what we were doing. We literally did. And then as the years went on, we started writing our own stuff and we had little sketches, but we were so heavily influenced by, actually I was quite influenced as well by the sort of Tommy Cooper age as well. I loved all that sort of stuff. And so the guy, but we loved all the Farshow and Vic and Bob and all those sort of things. So we were just slowly but surely evolving into the stuff we did. And so we ended up doing loads of sketches and we thoroughly enjoyed doing it, but we were doing 40 shows a year, 3 hours long, and we had to pack them full of sketches. So many of them didn't work, but we ended up learning that thing of getting catchphrases going as well. You know, people quite like to hit points where they know it's coming and then they go.
And so did that go out completely live?
Yeah, everything went out live.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the sort of energy of the original Big Night Out, that you throw stuff out there and it kind of doesn't quite work. It doesn't matter because you move on and it's live. And it's not that thing where you've spent weeks filming it, vast amounts of money.
Yeah, well, my favorite time ever on TV was being a guest on Shooting Stars. And, I couldn't believe I got to become a... I actually said to Vic and Bob, if I ever get on the Shooting Stars, I think I will retire. And then Vic...
That's probably the only reason they booked you.
Vic always says, you said you were going to retire. Why haven't you retired? But I went on it, and the energy that you get across on TV was the energy what it was like to be there and it was being filmed. Yeah. It was that anarchic. I was just fantastic. I absolutely loved it. Right, go on. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say when they were talking about putting the Big Night Out on TV, I tried to get them to put it out as a kind of live Saturday morning 3-hour thing.
Wow.
To preserve that spirit, which would have been incredible, but they put it out for adults instead.
Okay, what other jobs did you do? You've had a list of jobs, but painting, decorating was one of the ones you mentioned.
Yeah, me and the bass player in the band, the Higgsons, when we weren't on tour, we toured a lot, but when we had time off, we started to do bits of decorating in order to make a bit of money, because, you know, there's this idea now that bands can't make any money like they used to. Most bands never did. Right. Big bands made shitloads, but working day bands like ourselves, we never made any money. And the only money we made was out of touring, really. But we started to do a bit of decorating, and it was like, wow, I can buy a new pair of shoes and a new shirt. This is incredible. And that was one of the reasons the band split up, because we thought, you know, if we did decorating full time, we could actually make quite a lot of money. And we did. We were very good decorators. We were classic posh decorators. And, you know, if you're in London, there is millions of houses and they all need decorating. So you're never short of work. And we were nice and unthreatening for the nice middle class homeowners who would get us in, and we would do up their houses. And when Paul started working as a fancy plasterer, doing sort of making ceiling molds and running cornices and things, and so we'd often work together. We'd say, "Oh, you need a plaster? We'll get Paul and Martin in." And yeah, we'd often work on jobs together, and we would often pretend to be working class builders. how amusing that was. We would put on working class accents and take the piss out of the lower orders. And that was the sort of origins of Loads of Money.
Didn't you work on Stephen Fry's house or something?
We did. Yeah. Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie and a couple of their friends from university did that classic thing of buying a house together in East London. And Harry was working with them on things at the time, and Harry's a friend of ours, and they needed a decorator. And he said, "Oh, get Charlie and Paul and Colin in. They can do it." So we did. We did up their whole house and did it very nicely. And they all got fabulously wealthy and were able to go and buy their own houses, at which point Paul and I bought the house off them.
So
it worked out very well.
Was the scene quite tight then? Did everyone know each other from that comedy world?
Well, there was a group of people who'd been at university together. So there were producers like John Lloyd and Jeffrey Perkins, Phil Pope, who did a lot of music, Stephen and Hugh. All these guys were from Douglas Adams. There was a big group of them who were friends at university at the same time, and they sort of moved up and sort of took over comedy in many ways. Smith and Jones were part of it as well. So they were sort of the sort of elder statesmen for our generation. And then me and Paul and Harry were kind of like part of the next generation coming along past.
But you all knew each other and you all used to hang out and stuff.
Well, No, I mean, we knew Stephen and Hugh from working in their house, and that's how we got to know them. Harry knew them better than us. Harry was our kind of link. He was our conduit, and he was our way into comedy. It was Harry did a lot of live stuff, character stuff. He always needed stuff written for him. So Paul and I started writing bits and pieces for him. And he was very ambitious. He wanted to get on TV. He got onto Spitting Image. And again, it was a lot of the same people who worked on that and put that together. So, yeah, and then as he did Saturday Live, and again, it was the same producers and people like Stephen and Hugh involved in that. Ben Elton, again, was a friend of that lot. So we sort of grabbed onto their shirt tails and ended up in comedy, although neither of us had planned to do it.
Did they come to you to do the Farce show? Did the commissioner come to you, or did you take it to them?
Well, Paul and I have been working on a Harry Enfield television program, which did very well. But through that, we were sort of squirreling away bits and pieces that didn't work for that. Either there wasn't a character for Harry, or Harry didn't like it. Like, we tried to get him to do Suit You, but he didn't like it. And various other things. So we started compiling all this other material, because we didn't want to just be Harry's writers for all time. So we had all these bits and pieces, but weren't quite sure how to make it into a different show and how to make it different to what Paul was doing with Harry. I mean, one thing we knew, we said, well, let's try and do a proper team sketch show. So it's not like a sort of driven and led by one or two stars like Harry's show. And I mean, it's a story I've told many times, but the producer, Jeffrey Perkins, who was the greatest comedy producer of all time, put together a compilation for the second series of Harry's sketch show of all the new characters. He said, "I'm not going to show the whole show. We're just going to do little clips of all the characters." I said, "Well, they're not really going to work in clips, so you need to see the whole sketch." He says, no, it works quite well. And we looked at that, this sort of 20-minute thing that he'd done to promote the show for the press. And it was a real light bulb moment. We thought, wow, this is actually better than the long sketches that these that they're in. Why could we try and do a whole show that was just highlights, just clips like this? And so that gave us the idea. We nicknamed it the Fast Show. We never meant it to be called that. It's a terrible name. And we started trying to sell it around. And for a while, it was with Hattrick, and they were trying to get it onto ITV, who were saying, we really want to do comedy. But that wasn't going to work. And eventually, a new controller started at BBC Two, Michael Jackson. Not that Michael Jackson, obviously. No. And he was very good. He just started there. He'd lost a lot of his mainstream comedy, had moved over to BBC One, the likes of French and Saunders or whatever. So he was looking for new stuff. And then, you know, comedy was the really important backbone of BBC Two. And we went in to see him and said, look, we've been trying to develop this for ITV, maybe with Hattrick. We just wanted to know, you know, if would you have any interest in it? And he said, if you bring it to me and we make it as a BBC show, I'll commission it now. So we said, okay. And he did, which has never been known since. So it was, again, it was, we had the right thing at the right time and met the right person. And then we tried to find all the producers we liked, like John Lloyd and Jeffrey Perkins, were all busy or tied up in other things. And eventually, I think it was John Lloyd said, look, you know this show inside out. Why don't you just make it? You could produce it, you and Paul. And luckily, I'd worked very closely with Jeffrey Perkins, who produced Harry's show, and I learned a lot through him. So we did. The BBC gave us X amount of money. We said, no, the BBC said how much it will cost to make the series. We said, well, it'll cost this much. They said, we can't pay you that much. We'll give you this much. So we went away with the smaller amount they gave us and overspent. They just gave us some money. We went away and made a TV show and brought it back to them. And we said, I'm afraid we did actually spend more money. It did cost what we originally said it would cost. I said, oh, well, you've spent it now. and that was that.
You know what's weird about the if you're in a band, you put music out and then people either like it or they don't. And the idea that someone, just you saying that someone said, if you come to me now, I'll commission it. People saying yes in TV is an unbelievable feeling, isn't it? Because there's gatekeepers. There's someone between you and the audience who has to make a decision, which is why I always find the commissioning editors are the unsung heroes of Vic Reed's, Big Night Out, Fast Show, Monty Python, whoever, because someone's got to put their career and reputation on the line to let you near the viewers.
Yeah, well, I mean, the amazing thing was in the 90s, there was a fantastic lineup of commissioners at the BBC of really clever, talented people who were all into comedy and entertainment. And that's one of the reasons why you look back and the 90s was such an extraordinary amount of comedy. Mm. Great comedy. I don't want to be a sort of grumpy old man saying comedy was better then, but there was some classic comedy made and there was so much comedy made because at the BBC you had Michael Jackson who'd come in with a spirit of energy. He always reminded me of kind of Tony Blair swinging in and reviving labor in the country at the time. He had that sort of youthful energy about him. And then he had David Liddiment who'd come from Granada, who was a fantastic light entertainment man. He loved that side of it. Then you had Paul Jackson, who was one of the most brilliant producers around of comedy and entertainment. And you had Jeffrey Perkins there as a commissioner and John Plowman as joint commissioners. I mean, that lineup of those four people was extraordinary. And that was one of the main reasons that they did so well. The funny thing was at Channel 4, when Vic and Bob started on Vic Rees, the comedy commissioner there, I won't mention him by name, but he seemed to think that his job was to prevent any comedy from getting onto the channel by hook or by crook. But he had this enormous position of power. But the guys at the BBC, it was positive. It was saying, yeah, let's do some comedy. Let's make some more. That's great. Let's do that. Mm. And that's what you need. And that is, sadly, it is true that the BBC has changed, that the commissioners have much less power and there are more levels they've got to try and fight through to try and get stuff on. And it's dispiriting for them that you don't have that. And part of the reasons is because the BBC had more money in the 90s than they do now.
Yeah, one of my friends who's a comedian was telling me, she's not a friend, but he's someone I know of quite well. And he was telling me that one of the commissioners was telling him how to do comedy the other day. he was struggling with that concept. I suppose the problem is, I'm not looking for headlines here, Charlie. Trust me on this. But the problem is putting comedy on TV now, it's a very hard thing to do. I listen to a lot of American podcasts with the comedians, and they say whenever they do their routines now, there's pushback on a lot of the stuff they do. You can imagine the sketch show, some of the stuff you've done, some of the stuff that you talked about, Matt Lucas there earlier, etc., etc. A lot of it now is not acceptable, and a lot of it is, yes, use some modern words, triggering, and people are not happy with any form of comedy aimed at any human being. So it's quite difficult. Yeah. As I say, I'm not looking for any headlines here, Charlie.
Well, I mean, no, but I mean, the thing is, you know, the people say that, oh, Farshow wouldn't get on now. I say, well, it is on now. They've just started again. It's on UK TV on Gold. They've just started again, repeating the whole thing from episode one. And they go, they keep showing it and going around. They don't get any complaints. It's not a problem. I personally, I think that thing about, you know, you can't say what you want to say. You can't make comedy these days. I don't fully buy into that. Now, the BBC, because they've been hammered by successive governments, are always on the back foot, and they're way too defensive. They do have to now try and please everybody, and therefore they run the risk of pleasing nobody. But the thing is, you know, young people genuinely, you know, I got three boys in their 20s, and they genuinely, they view the world differently to how I did. I mean, Christ, yes. the comedy I watched in the 70s, the likes of Benny Hill, it was appalling. Some of the stuff, there was some great stuff, and there was some stuff that even at the time you thought, well, that's not on really, is it? And that stuff, you know, shouldn't be made. And, you know, my kids are not coming from a thing of, oh, they've studied a book of what they should think or feel about things. They genuinely, and their generation genuinely thinks some things are funnier than others. And there are certain things that, no, you can't say that. Mm. But it's always interesting, because it's always been a sort of seesaw thing, a push and a pull. I remember back in the day, Hugh Laurie always used to say, alternative comedy never really happened. You know, there was this idea that suddenly everybody had to be politically correct. He said, yeah, you know, there was a bit of that. And then suddenly it was everybody saying, aha, well, I'm making comedy that kicks against the new, this new regime, and I'm going against political correctness. And you'll always have that, you know, the likes of Jimmy Carr or Frankie Boyle or whatever, who are pushing at it and thinking, what can I get away with? Let's see. And some people will laugh and some people won't. And that I think it keeps comedy fresh. You don't keep doing the same thing. You look at new ways to do comedy. And, you know, there are new stand-ups coming along who will make jokes of different things. Because I've always thought a lot of stand-up, you thought, you're getting away with that because there's a big audience who are really laughing. But actually what you're saying is really unacceptable.
Yeah, I suppose we go back all the way to Bernard Manning in the times, and he refused to change his act, didn't he? Absolutely refused to. Just,
well, that was his act, and he would always have enough people who were happy to come along and pay to see him in his club. I mean, obviously, he didn't get on. He stopped being on TV with it. But if he'd wanted, he could have got on TV. He could have changed his act and done that, because he was a funny guy. He was a clever guy. He knew how to tell a joke, and he didn't. But he just thought, I've got my life. This is how it's sorted. I've got my club. I do my gigs there. It gives me enough money to live the life that I want.
Hmm. We've got 15 minutes left. And
right. How many questions?
Well, let's go. I'm going to shoot around a bit now. I'll go, right. What were you like at school? Let's do that one.
I was shy, a bit nerdy, but in a sort of arty way. I was always trying to swim against the stream, dress differently to the sort of mainstream, and be into different things. So I was into sort of foreign films and long, difficult books. And I had a small but committed friendship group. And we started putting on sort of comedy plays and things, completely ripped off Monty Python. I was quite shy behind it all. And it was an all boys school, so I didn't really get to know any girls. So my portrayal of Ralph in the Ted and Ralph sketches in the Var show, it came very naturally to me because I just channeled what I was like as a teenager at a disco trying to talk to a girl. So in many ways, I was like Ralph. Okay. With a bit of Colin Hunt.
What is your outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad.
I don't think I've ever had any. It's a funny thing. You go through your life thinking, I'm pretty sharp. I'm pretty cool. I'm keeping up with things. I'm quite well-dressed. But you look back at any photo taken more than 5 years ago and you think, what was I wearing? Why did I think that was a good look? It just felt right at the time, but I've never really managed to pull off full stylishness. So I've consistently got things wrong.
Sadly, this is audio and not visual. But you've got very long hair at the moment. Would have seen. No, I like it. I think it suits you. The first time I saw it, I was quite horrified. But now I've seen you a few.
From doing your show the other day, I did get a lot of comments along the lines of, looks like Westwood's got one of the hairy bites. I've called you Westwood again.
Oh, again.
I did on a fucking show. I got a fucking mental block. It looks like Lovejoy has got one of the fucking hairy bikers on again. And again, I've got quite a talent, actually, for looking in a mirror and making my face look like how I want it to look in my mind. I always think, yes, that looks good. The hair looks fine. And it's only when you look at a photograph, you think, oh, no, that's not how I looked in the mirror. And some of the shots, yes, from your show, Mr. Lovejoy, there was a lot of Dave King off.
I love the idea.
Of the hairy bikers.
I love the idea that you're getting me mixed up with Tim Westwood.
It's a mental block because it's terrible. If ever I do a TV show, a live show or something, and I try and prepare something in advance, it always goes wrong and comes out really stilted and horrible. So I try not to. I much prefer if I can just say something spontaneously, it's going to be funnier. So I was on your show and I had this thing about you and Simon Rimmer both got no hair and I've got lots of hair. I'll do a thing about that. And of course I completely cocked it up. But in the panic of the moment thinking, yes, I've got this great prepared bit. Yes. Westwood and Rimmer. Oh, fuck. It's I don't know what to do about my hair again. You know, I think I'm going to look back on this. I mean, it's lockdown hair and I've done it as a joke to see what it would look like. And it's gone too far. And I'm at that stage of, do I keep it long or just shave it all off? And I know I'm going to look back and look at some photos and think, oh, my God.
You know, one of the questions here is what is your relationship like with social media? But just before you do that, it's what's really funny about doing Sunday brunch? What's strange? Sunday morning, there seems to be this set of people who watch the show and just hammer every guest. And I feel responsible and embarrassed about it because any guest who comes on who looks like you look different, you've got long hair or someone might put a bit of weight on, lost a bit of weight, worn a top. They just get like, there's this massive pile on and every week we trend because the viewers are hammering one of the guests. I feel so responsible and I hate it. And I really want to say to all the guests when they come on, please don't look at social media when you're on.
But it's the pact. It's the pact. You know, you're doing TV to publicize something. You've got to accept people are going to look at it. And in the past, people always thought those things, but we just never knew what they were thinking. They'd go down a pub with their mates and say it. People are saying social media has changed the way people think. No, it's not. It's just showed us what people think.
Yeah.
And I mean, luckily I'm treated fairly well on social media. I haven't done anything to upset people. And as long as you steer clear of politics and the like, people tend to be pretty nice to you. And they showed the pictures of me next to Dave the Hairy Biker and we looked very similar.
Do you like social media though? Do you like using it? Do you think it's a good...
Well, I use Twitter. I don't do any of the others. And actually for a writer, Twitter is quite a good medium. There are a lot of writers on Twitter because you know, your life is sitting alone in a little room typing away at something. And it's quite nice to actually communicate with other writers and to communicate with your fans to have access to that. And, you know, on Twitter, I really connect and respond if people talk about my books or that side of my life. much more than if they're talking about the Fast Show or something like that, because that's kind of out there and they can talk amongst themselves on that. That's fine. But if it's to do with books, I'll encourage that and do what I can, because it's really hard selling books. If you make a TV series, it's there on the screen. If you want to watch it, you switch it on. You can look at, you know, there's always going to be trailers and promos for it, and there it is. But a book's not like that. You can, there's not, it's, you know, if you're reading another book, every three pages, I mean, it might do if you're reading an ebook, but every three pages, it doesn't give you a list of other books you might enjoy.
I got the best piece of advice, by the way, from your podcast. I use classical music, and I told you this when you came on Sunday brunch. I've always used classical music to calm the children. And it's if you're listening to this and you've got children, as soon as you get in a car and they're shouting, you put classical music on, it just is the most amazing thing for settling children down, and in the kitchen if they're angry or whatever. But I've never really used it to work with, and I use silence. And I'm writing something at the moment. I'm writing another thing that can be rejected, Charlie. But you said use classical music, and I thought, well, I can't, because classical music, it jumps around too much, and it's, you know. And then you mentioned, is it Philip Glass? Is that, have I got the name right? Because I went straight onto it. What was the name of the, is that his name?
Yeah, Philip Glass. In fact, I'll send you a link, because I've done a playlist called Music for Writing, which I put together for Bob Mortimer, actually, which is largely Philip Glass. So I'll send you a link to that.
So I went straight on that after you talked to Bob about it. And it's beautiful for writing too, because it just bubbles, as you said on the podcast, it just bubbles away in the background. It's really nice. It just sort of...
Lots of writers write to with Philip Glass. And it sort of slowly unfolds rather than shouts at you.
I like the idea that I was called a writer there, because I'm...
Anybody who writes is a writer. We're all a writer. We're all writers, really. You can talk, you can write.
Yeah, I'm not writing a book, sadly. It's another format. Now, okay, I want to get onto this question, because it's my favourite one. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
No.
Oh, no. So disappointing. Do you believe in them?
You?
No. See, I'm so upset, because the two things...
Have you ever come across someone who has on this?
Yeah, loads.
I mean, you know, it is so clearly a manifestation of one's own mind.
Both of them?
You know, we've got... Yes, they're exactly the same sort of thing. We've got... you know, our mind is this little strange thing trapped inside our head, and nobody knows the relationship really between the mind and the brain. And it can't see or hear anything. It can't talk. It can't move. But it's there. So it's got these receptors. A signal comes into our eyes, and our brain translates that into a visual image. A vibration comes into our ears, and our sound. Our brain translates that into a sound, etc. So it is very, very easy for our brain to create ghosts and UFOs or whatever. And those people that see them fully believe in them. And they have seen a ghost, because their brain has created one. And that's what seeing is. But the idea that this is somehow a manifestation of a dead spirit is absolutely ludicrous. And as for UFOs, yeah, there are lights in the sky and strange phenomena. And one gets flashes in one's eyes, and it's very easy to imagine that might be something else. Even the things you see filmed, you know, here it's uncontrovertible proof that three lines of stripes of light went through the air. That's not uncontrovertible truth. Proof that there is an alien fucking civilization out there that comes down to Earth, but rather than actually coming up and shaking our hands, decides to whiz across the sky in the form of three bright lights that an actual pilot saw, or someone who works for the American Air Force. No, I have no time for ghosts and UFOs, and I have no time for the idiots that see them and believe in them.
What happens when you die then? Is there a point to all this, Charlie?
I think the point to life is you have been given this extraordinary gift of life, of experiencing all this amazing world that is around us and all the amazing things we can do. And obviously terrible things can happen, but on the whole, enjoy your life. It's there for you, and experience everything you can and embrace it, and you know, make sure everybody around, try and make sure they've all got good lives too. Don't be, why be nasty to people? Be kind. Mm-hmm. And that is the point of life, is yes, that we can experience it, and we should. And let's not worry about what happens after.
I always say, if all else fails, try empathy, and it really works. Mm. I struggle with Twitter a lot. I struggle with so many celebrities on there who do get involved in politics, and they do get involved in just hammering people. And I just think, you're not doing yourself any good there. Just show some empathy. Be a bit loving, and it's a better way to live your life. Do you believe in free will?
Ah, well, this is a big one at the moment, isn't it? I've been reading a bit about that. It's really fascinating, that idea that the laws of physics mean you have the Big Bang, and then for the next second, everything had happened exactly because of what those atoms and molecules were doing. And there was only one thing they could do next. And that all of development and all of life has only had one path that it can possibly take. And therefore, everything we do in our lives has been determined by what happened a millisecond ago and a millisecond ago before that. And we can't choose what happens. And, you know, that is an interesting philosophical angle. But at the same time, you know, I talk to my wife about philosophy sometimes, and she says, well, what's the point of it? It's a complete waste of time. What difference does it make? You know, life is life. Is it free will or not? Who knows? It makes no difference to how we experience it, knowing that or not knowing that. So again, it comes back to, we'll just go ahead and experience it and go along for the ride. What does it matter what it means?
I suppose, because if there's free will, it means we can change it. And then if we can change it, we've got our destiny in our own hands. So,
but you're only saying that because of everything that happened before that led up to making you say that.
So Stuart Lee on my show the other day, he was on a Zoom call, and right at the end of the interview, he starts talking about fate and whether I believe my life was predetermined, and I'm sat there going, I can't answer this. I mean, it's like, you know, we're on the Sunday morning, Stuart. It's like, but he was enjoying going, Tim Lovejoy, what do you think about that? Is your life predetermined?
It comes down to, what difference does it make? It's the whole, it's like a bloody Matrix thing. Everybody there stuck in the Matrix, and it's not the real world. Well, if you're having a fine time, does it matter?
I suppose, because what happens, Charlie, is like, it's happened to me. Actually, John Lloyd discussed this on this podcast. It happened to him where you have a bit of a breakdown, and then you start looking around life and going, hold on, this doesn't make sense. And I don't feel very well, and I don't feel good about things. So you start looking into philosophy, and then you start working out how your brain works. And then, you know, I've done so many podcasts on the brain on this podcast because I became fascinated with it. And so that's why I suppose it matters, because you're trying to find release.
Yeah, if things break down and things go wrong, or you need some guidance, then some philosophy can be very helpful. Some can make you even worse, like the idea of the clockwork universe and lack of free will. But you know, you know, again, breakdowns are often physical things. They're scientific things that's, you know, chemicals have gone wrong in your body or whatever. I'm a big believer, and this is coming back in a big way now, the whole sort of use of LSD and psilocybin in depression, because it takes away the ego, and it takes away that that controlling brain. And it is incredibly effective for depression.
So the recent study they did on psilocybin, I put myself on the trial and I did it. They're just really, I think this will go out in a couple of weeks, but there's a program on, I think tomorrow night, on David Nutt, who oversaw it all, about how it was. It's been the most amazing experience. I haven't done the podcast yet because I'm still waiting for their findings to come out. And when they are, then I can get them on to talk about it. But by the way, I won't recommend that anyone goes and does psilocybin unless they're in the right environment, which in a hospital and all that. But they did the MRI scans on me before and after, and there's been changes in my brain. So it's been quite an interesting trip. Yeah, you're right about that. We should be doing more experimentation on MDMA.
Well, it comes back to that idea that of our brain and our mind and our consciousness being locked inside our head, and you know, you can't open it up and tinker with it like a car engine. But there are things like, you know, there are other ways of getting in there and rummaging around and fixing things. There's a fantastic book called Entangled Lives, which is about mushrooms and lichen and fungi, that's a general term, and about how important it is in the world just in terms of ecology. But also there is a chapter about psilocybin, and it's really interesting. It's looking at, you know, is there an evolutionary advantage for mushrooms to have developed psilocybin and things like that? And you know, has human evolution been changed by psilocybin? It's a really interesting book.
They reckon humans started taking it and it just opened their minds up to come out of the jungle and start standing up.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, there's a lot of people say, well, that's the birth of religion and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah. Just finally on this, I'm doing a podcast soon with a guy who talks about consciousness. I've just started his book and I find it very scary because he starts talking about general anesthetic. And he says, when you go into general anesthetic, you don't know how long you're under for, but whilst you're under, you're more or less dead because you don't remember any of it when you come back. And he's sort of implying that we managed to turn off consciousness. Which he's not implying at all. He's saying that we turn off consciousness. And then what's scary about that is I've always envisaged when I die, something magical happens. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it just...
But you can believe that because you're never going to know one way or the other. Well, maybe you are, you know. It'll be a great result for you if something magical does happen. You know, again, it's like philosophy. It's not going to make any difference.
Yeah. So the final question then, we've come to the end of our hours. What's the meaning of life?
I thought we just discussed that for the last hour.
We pretty much have. Just enjoy yourself.
In the words of Derek Smalls. Oh, no, is it Derek Smalls or is it the drummer? Have a good time all of the time.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Charlie. Your podcast, by the way, is that going to carry on forever?
That's down to Scala, really, because it was a sort of byproduct of doing the radio shows. So I hope they'll do some more. I think the podcast has been quite popular and successful for them. So I'd love to do some more. I think without having the sort of backbone of being able to play the classical music, I wouldn't do it. I suppose that's my shtick for the podcast. So, but who knows? Maybe I will just sit down and talk to someone for an hour. But I like having the music.
Yeah, I love it. I recommend it to everyone. Thanks so much, Charlie. Thanks for joining me today.
And you, Tim.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.